May it please the court and counsel. My name is Patrick Compton. I represent Ashley Kinsey in this case. My bar number is 34425. This is a curious case for me to present on oral argument. Typically, I like to come before the division and say, this is how the facts of this particular case lines up with applicable precedent. And I can't do that here because there are not factual findings in the record on which I can make a factual comparison. What you have in this particular case is a series of procedural errors that have culminated in the imposition of sanctions without factual findings. The court can simply review a 25-page hearing transcript that constitutes a contempt order, and a two-sentence order on attorney's fees and costs. Doesn't even need to take my word for what transpired. It's all there. And given the time constraints, I'll focus on a handful of errors associated with the procedures in this particular case. But I think, as I mentioned before, the most critical one is that we have imposition of sanctions in a contempt hearing without any express findings of fact. As the panel knows, there's a series of cases on this. We have the Elliott case, the Ledesky case, the Searing and Kay case. I also believe, if I'm not mistaken, that it was addressed briefly in the Webb and Christensen case, on which Judge Daly concurred with the Webb opinion. But in order to impose sanctions on contempt, you have to have factual findings that a party didn't comply with the lawful order of the court, that the party knew of that order, and that the party had the present ability to purge its contempt on the day of the actual hearing. And here, we have, as I mentioned, a 25-page contempt hearing transcript where the word fine wasn't even uttered or used. I think the word, and frankly, I can't recall if the word contempt was even used at the hearing. I think it was implied by use of the phrase remedial sanctions. But we don't have any findings. We don't have any declaration of someone being in contempt. And I think the reason why that's the case leads to our next point of error. Another crucial error is just there isn't an evidentiary predicate that the court had on which to base factual findings. And the reason why is because there wasn't an evidentiary hearing that was held. I think it's our position that you need to hold an evidentiary hearing in the context of a contempt procedure, that's non-waivable. I recognize that's based on a case from 1976 that wasn't selected for official publication.
Excuse me. Sure. You say that's non-waivable? You mean a party can't waive its right to an evidentiary hearing?
I don't believe so, Your Honor.
The court can force you into an evidentiary hearing.
And if I could explain that, Your Honor, because I think that's a great question. And that goes to the nub of this. I think it's non-waivable in this context. I think if you're going to find somebody in contempt, you need evidence on which to base that, to base your factual findings. I think the clearest way is to have the evidentiary hearing and just go about it that way. I think there's a scenario where you could envision where other admissible evidence is incorporated into the record, so that you can have factual findings based on that. But as I mentioned, I think the Simmons case, in that particular case, both parties submitted competing, well, they're the function of affidavits. They were labors and material estimates. And the court in that particular case, the Court of Appeals, said, you know, that's not good enough because there isn't admissible evidence on which we can base our determination. That was simply hearsay that was submitted into the record.
Well, here, let's take a specific example because you just touched on the issue of affidavits. We have your client's affidavit.
We do.
It's introduced. It's stipulated to that it comes in. The court asks you, well, is your client going to say anything other than what is in his affidavit? And you say, no. Well, then you don't really need him to testify. I mean, how can you object that he wasn't allowed to testify if you concede?
Sure.
You kind of consented to him not testifying.
Well, and I recognize that, and I appreciate that, Your Honor. And I think if that is the only evidence that's in the record in this particular case, and that's, as I mentioned, incorporated into the record and incorporated on which you could base factual findings, we still have the issue that there aren't any factual findings within the contempt hearing transcript. But if you do incorporate that affidavit testimony here, that requires the Court of Appeals to reverse with express instructions I'm sorry, to remand with express instructions to find my client not in contempt, because the affidavit unequivocally reflects that on the day of the contempt hearing, the third element of the contempt, the third required element, it couldn't be proven.
Well, as I recall, though, opposing counsel strenuously urged that your client should not be believed based upon certain history. So the court isn't required to believe the affidavit.
And I appreciate that as well, Your Honor. I think the question then becomes a judicial predetermination or prejudging of credibility of a witness. And I think that therein is a problem. If we have, okay, we're going to incorporate a prior affidavit, introduce that in evidence, and then doubt the veracity of that particular affidavit, I don't think the district court is serving its function in a contempt hearing. I think you have to have competing testimony on those particular issues. But as I mentioned, if the answer is we're going to accept the affidavit as true, then what we're dealing with is similar to the Webb versus Christensen case, a one-time non-purchable event unequivocally demonstrated by the sole evidence within the record. Now, with respect to that, I think that particular issue, the ability to purge contempt, or the ability to the present ability to comply with the order on the day of the contempt hearing, that is so fundamental in a contempt proceeding that the appellee in this case, JSI, within its original enforcement motion, within its contempt motion, specifically said, and this is on page 146 of the record, that in order to enforce the injunction, the court must determine that Mr. Kinsey is capable of compliance. If we accept that the affidavit is the only evidence within the record on which factual findings could be based, there's only one possible outcome here, and that's no finding of contempt. In addition to that, though, there are other, as I mentioned, structural errors associated with this contempt proceeding. And one of those, I think, is the interesting question of selective closure of the courtroom. I understand that the Hassan decision is now pending before the Supreme Court on cert review. And so I couldn't come in here and tell you definitively whether or not it is a clear structural error. The Supreme Court's going to provide us guidance on that. But what I can tell you is that if you are going to, as a district court, selectively close a courtroom, once again, you have to make specific findings.
Well, and counsel, on that issue, doesn't the record show that the people who were excluded were witnesses that had been subpoenaed and then released from their subpoenas? And the record doesn't show that anybody else was excluded from the courtroom, nor does the record show any objection by you to this, what you call, selective closure of the courtroom.
And actually, Your Honor, if I could address that, I think the record actually reflects that the first person who was excluded from the courtroom was not a party who was subpoenaed as a witness.
Was the attorney, as I recall. In-house counsel.
He was in-house counsel.
Okay.
And he was excluded from the court. And I think to interpose an objection on the record so as to provide for appellate review, the answer is simple. You just have to provide notice of impending error to the district court. And my co-counsel who handled the hearing, John Shannon, did so in saying, I think this is a public courtroom. But beyond that, though,
what's the prejudice to your client?
As I mentioned, Judge Roman, I don't think you have to demonstrate prejudice. I think that this is a structural error that defies harmless error analysis. I think it both, in my thought for why that's the case, is I think it both protects the litigants, but it also protects the public at large.
How can a partial closure like this be structural error when we have a rule of evidence that expressly allows trial courts to exclude witnesses from the courtroom, and that happens daily? So it can't be structural error to exclude people from a courtroom. It has to be a total closure, it seems to me. I don't know of any case that says this kind of partial closure thing is a structural error.
Well, and I think the answer to that question is because the closure is selective, the problem is not exclusion of witnesses pursuant to the rules of evidence so as to preclude, say, collusive testimony or parties for matching up their testimony. What we had in this particular case is somebody who was just instructed to leave for no basis. I'll say this, if there was a, if the district court had theoretically said upon the record, I am going to exclude you because of the rule of evidence, or I'm going to make these factual determinations that are required under the Hassan decision, you know, an overriding interest, making the restriction as narrow as possible, considering reasonable alternatives. That'd be one set of scenarios. But what we have here is just the district court, Judge Klein, saying, this is my courtroom right now. You need to leave.
But the circumstances at the time that he did that were that you were indicating, your co-counsel was indicating, I should say, that there was going to be a lot of evidence about some trade secrets coming out of this hearing. We had witnesses subpoenaed to testify about all that stuff. And can't a witness be excluded for that reason so that that witness doesn't learn about trade secrets during a proceeding?
And certainly, Your Honor, I would say that a witness can be excluded for that if you have the adequate findings on the record to demonstrate that that's what in fact transpired. As we sit here today, all we can do is guess and surmise, and that doesn't allow this court to function and make the decision as to whether or not what was done was proper.
So if we can exclude a witness for proprietary information, you still maintain that it's structural in this case?
Oh, in this particular case, absolutely, Your Honor, and that's because we don't know why or what happened. I certainly appreciate the court's question on this, and I think that it's absolutely correct that when factual findings involving the specific issues of required foreclosure are met and asserted by the district court so that this court can do its job, that's one thing, and I agree with that 100%. But if we don't have anything within the record to reflect that that's what occurred, I think you have necessarily error on that particular issue. I'd like to reserve my remaining 3 minutes. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel.
Good afternoon. May it please the court. My name is Darren Nadel from Littler Mendelsohn. With me at council table is Catherine Dix from my firm. I think it's important to start with the standard of review in any appellate case. There are a number of issues, and I think the parties have agreed in their briefing that on each of the issues before this court, the standard of review is abuse of discretion, which means that this court's task is not to decide what it might have done in the same circumstances as a district judge, but instead to decide simply whether what the district judge did was one of many permissible outcomes. So what is the order being appealed from? It's really a simple order. It says, since you can't give over the hard drive, give over your other electronic storage devices to make sure that whatever you took from UE when you left the company and downloaded stuff on your last day of employment and then wiped the hard drive clean so that your tracks would be covered, let's just find another way to make sure that that stuff hasn't gone anywhere else, that you no longer possess it. It's not an onerous order, and it's not an order that's out of line with the injunction from which it flows. It's true that Mr. Kinsey could not turn over a hard drive that he claims, it's never been proven, he claims he threw away, notably, very shortly after the litigation was filed. We know that the litigation was filed July 29th, 2011. Mr. Kinsey's counsel represented to the court at the May 31st hearing that the hard drive was destroyed in August 2011, shortly thereafter, which means the judge, in response to your question, Judge Jones, the judge had every reason to doubt the credibility of Mr. Kinsey. There was no prejudgment. There was a basis for that judgment. He had acknowledged destroying key evidence during the course of the litigation. He had represented in his first affidavit to the court, which was filed during temporary restraining order proceedings, that he had not misappropriated anything, and we've quoted that in our brief. And it turns out that he had. So well, the question then is...
Well, counsel, assuming that the court did have information before it that would permit it to make a credibility finding, there really isn't one in the record. The court didn't say, I don't believe the affidavit. I think he could have turned over this particular hard drive. We don't have any kind of a finding like that.
Not a specific finding about turning over the hard drive, but the judge did on the record say that I have reasons to doubt Mr. Kinsey's credibility, and I'm not sure that I would believe anything that he had to say. That's something that District Court Judge Klein did say on the record, and there's a good reason for that. The briefing in front of the district court had pointed out the fact that Mr. Kinsey had destroyed a hard drive that contained evidence that was central to the litigation, and it came out at the hearing that in fact that the hard drive was destroyed in August 2011, and so putting two and two together that the case was filed on July 29th, 2011, it must have been destroyed immediately after the litigation was filed. That's cause for serious concern. So, but ultimately, none of that really matters, because the reason you don't have an evidentiary hearing in front of you is because Mr. Kinsey's counsel stipulated to everything the court needed to know in order to find contempt. And the record is very clear on that. When it comes to the exclusion of Mr. Bernard, Mr. Chaman said, he first said, well, this courtroom's open to the public. And the court said, well, but it's my courtroom right now. And then Mr. Chaman said, well, Mr. Bernard certainly does not have to be here, Your Honor. At that point, why would the court make factual findings or take evidence about whether there is or is not going to be proprietary information discussed during the hearing? Certainly, the briefing that led up to the hearing, where there was a request made to exclude Credit Suisse from the hearing, the arguments in that briefing said very simply, there's some chance that the trade secrets that UE is trying to keep away from Credit Suisse is going to be discussed during this hearing. Therefore, we object to Credit Suisse having representatives at the hearing. That's how it started. And the district court certainly could have gone through and taken evidence about whether the information that was going to be discussed was or was not a trade secret or not. It already had in the record a number of the documents itself that were going to be exhibits. So the court already had in front of it reason to believe that the information could be proprietary. But none of that matters, because the reason the district court didn't do it, the reason the court didn't go district court didn't go further is because Mr. Chaman said he can leave. If you want him to be excused, he certainly does not have to be here. You can't tell the district court, on the one hand, he doesn't need to be here, and then come to the Court of Appeals and complain, we don't have an adequate record because I stipulated that he doesn't need to be here. It's not that there's not an adequate record, it's that there were stipulations to everything. None of the facts were in dispute because counsel and Mr. Kinsey himself represented to the court everything that the court needed to know to make factual findings, and the court, in fact, did make factual findings. It starts with the district court saying, there's a lot of briefing in front of me, but there's a very limited issue. And that is the return of the hard drive and some computer equipment. I'm looking at page 657, starting on line 19 of the transcript of that hearing. And both Mr. Channon and I said, that's correct, that's the issue. So the starting point is we've got a very narrow issue, so you only need evidence related to that issue. Immediately after that, on page 658, there's of the record in front of this court, there's a dialogue, not under oath, but a dialogue between Mr. Kinsey and District Court Judge Klein, in which Mr. Kinsey acknowledges he doesn't have the hard drive to return, and that he also did not have the hard drive to return at the time that he entered into the stipulation, which leads to the factual finding that Mr. Kinsey knowingly entered into a stipulation that was soon to become an order of the court, in the event the court adopted the stipulation and made it its own order. But he entered into a settlement that called for him to do something significant that he knew he could not do at the time he entered into the stipulation. So the question is, does that amount to an inability to purge the contempt? Can one put themselves in the position where they have no ability to purge the contempt because at the time they agree to the stipulation that is going to become a court order, they know they'll never be able to comply? The answer to that obviously is no. You can't put yourself in a situation where you have no ability to comply and then say, This provision no longer can be enforced. It doesn't apply to me because I never was able to comply with it. Instead, of course, the district court has the power to fashion an alternative remedy that comes as close as possible to doing what the original order was supposed to do.
Counsel, I'm having trouble with this argument because we have in our case law these requirements that a court has to make findings on. And you're basically saying the two of them don't apply here. The requirement that the party had the ability to comply with the order at the time it was entered, and secondly, the present ability to comply on the date of the hearing. And we have no findings on that one way or the other. But what I hear you saying is that it doesn't matter?
I'm not saying it doesn't matter. I'm saying that a party can't put themselves in a position where they have no ability to comply and then claim that they have no ability to purge the contempt, because purging contempt is not identically the same as complying with the original order. Purging contempt does not have to be done by doing exactly what the original order said. It can be by reaching a similar result that you can comply with. And I don't think that there's any disagreement in the case law about that, that a party can and that can be ordered to do something different that gets you to the same place, and that they can't escape their obligation to comply with a court order because they created a situation where they never would have been able to comply with it to begin with.
Well, it sounds like what you're doing is saying that there's got to be some remedy for the fact that there may have been some misrepresentation, failure to disclose to the court at the time the stipulation was entered into. That sounds an awful lot like punitive contempt, not remedial contempt.
Well, Rule 107 defines punitive contempt as contempt that involves jail time. This is clearly remedial contempt under Rule 107. There's no punishment in the form of jail time or taking away of rights. There's simply a requirement that he produce, that he pay attorney's fees, and that he produce electronic storage devices to be examined. So it doesn't fit. But
how can there be remedial contempt if the party does not have the ability to comply with the order? Under our case law, how can that be?
Because the obligation isn't to comply with the original order. The obligation is to purge the contempt. And one can purge the contempt in ways other than complying with the
original order. So that's the fourth requirement. The third requirement is that the party had the ability to comply when the order was entered, okay, to do what the order said. And if you're conceding here today that he did not, how can there be a finding under that factor, all of which have to be met, of remedial contempt?
What we're saying is that Mr. Kinsey claims he has no ability to comply. There's no way to prove otherwise save search his apartment in New York, right? I mean, here's somebody who has made misrepresentations to the court, who is now saying that he had no ability to comply with the stipulation he entered into and has no credibility. And he's now saying, and by the way, I don't have the hard drive. There's no way save from a search from his apartment to make him produce the hard drive.
Are you saying he should be stopped from being able to complain that he could not have complied with the order at the time it was entered?
Certainly, although I am making that argument, although I don't think I have to. I don't think that's my only argument, because I can also say that even if the way you got to the inability to comply with the letter of the original order was not through fraud on the court, although this was fraud on the court, even if you got there from a different avenue, you can still, the district court still has the power to enter a remedial sanction that achieves the same result as the original order, even if it's not identical to the way the original order went about it.
But my understanding is if the court does that, that's the purging of the contempt, then the party complies with that, then the contempt is purged. But we don't have any of that before us.
And Mr. Kinsey had been ordered to comply, to purge his contempt by producing the electronic storage devices that he did own for forensic analysis. That was the court's method of allowing Mr. Kinsey to purge his contempt.
How do we know that? Because I've read the transcript and I don't see any findings. That's what the court was doing. I mean, the court doesn't mention these requirements. It looks like there's kind of a conversation going back and forth as to, well, how best can we, you know, we kind of need to modify this order here. Let's have them do this, and then you can check it out if you're dissatisfied. You can have your own guy come in. I mean, it sounds like the parties are kind of negotiating, if you will, with the court about how this is going to be going forward. It doesn't really look like contempt to me.
Well, first of all, the district court does make some findings. So, for example, on page 669, the court says, what I heard today is Mr. Kinsey had at most two hard drives. One of these was a personal hard drive. The other was a company drive. So for Mr. Kinsey to sit on his hands and say, gee, I did nothing. I destroyed this back in August. We negotiated a settlement in November is simply disingenuous. That's one of the findings that the court makes on the issue, that Mr. Kinsey had committed fraud on the court. And that's not the only one. Let me quickly find for you.
So in making that finding, did the judge implicitly accept the fact that, you know, that he was unable to produce the that hard drive?
I believe that that what the district court was saying is what Mr. Kinsey is acknowledging is that he never had the ability to comply, and having entered into an order knowing that he didn't have the ability to comply and intentionally duping everyone, he's going to have to purchase contempt another way. That's what I think the district court was doing. Again, on page 670.
But that kind of gets to back to our requirements, though. I mean, back to what contempt is and what remedial contempt is as opposed to what punitive contempt is. The remedial contempt presumes that we have an order that everybody knows about that he can comply with. Okay? Those are kind of presumptions underlying that. And the whole idea behind remedial contempt is to give that party an opportunity to comply with the order. It sounds to me like you're just saying that there's this almost this third kind of contempt here.
Well, it certainly is not punitive contempt, because Rule 107A4 defines punitive contempt as unconditional fine, fixed sentence for imprisonment, or both.
No, I'm not saying it is, because you obviously didn't ask for punitive contempt. It just sounds like maybe the concepts are being conflated here. That is, the conduct involved really doesn't seem to lend itself to remedial contempt.
So remedial contempt includes, this is Rule 107A5, either a lawful order to compel performance, either compliance with a lawful order, that's the underlying order, right? That's the literal language, or, that's the key, or to compel performance of an act within the person's power or present ability to perform. That or means that there's two ways to allow remedial contempt under 107A5. One of them is compliance with the existing order. The other is the power to do something else that you are capable of doing. And it had been established on the record that Mr. Kinsey had other electronic storage devices in his possession. He acknowledged that on the record. And the district court said, okay, well, since you have the power to do that, I'm going with Part B of 107A5. I'm going with the or to compel performance of an act within the person's power or present ability to perform. I know I'm out of time.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
I'll be very brief. We've heard a lot of attorney arguments about how bad my client is. None of that was presented in evidence to the district court. That's critical for this court to consider. If they wanted to accept his affidavit as true, they had to accept his affidavit as true. And Judge Jones, as you pointed out, the affidavit unequivocally demonstrates that the third element of contempt cannot be met because he could not comply with the injunction order on the day of the contempt.
Well, I'm not, just to be clear, I'm not saying it couldn't be met. I'm saying I don't see a finding that it couldn't be met.
Well, and thank you. And now I appreciate you mentioning that, Judge, because now I, too, am going back to essentially I've gotten riled up and I wanted to litigate the underlying issues because, let's face it, my client has a story here to tell about the parade of horribles that you just heard. And I trust that he's going to have the opportunity to tell that story someday. But there aren't factual findings for this Court of Appeals to make that decision, and you're absolutely right. This court's job is not to make those factual findings, it's just to consider the record before it. With respect to this issue of alternative compliance, and whether or not you can
put yourself into a position where you can't comply with a court order? I think there are two responses to that. One, everything you've heard of is alleged, and mind you, alleged conduct that arose before.
Let me ask about the alleged conduct. Wasn't it your affidavit or your statement on the record that he disposed of it in August 2011?
Absolutely.
And wasn't it, you know, your agreement or your client's agreement reached in July of 2011?
There was an agreement reached in the stipulation, and the language of that stipulation we read differently than JSI's attorneys do. We have a different interpretation of that injunction. And I think that that's something that the court, frankly, under the Ireland Wynkoop decision should have considered as well. There are different opinions as to what the injunction means and what it says, and whether or not the requirement was to provide items that were solely in the possession and control of the parties. That's the answer to that question. But once again, that's something that there are no factual findings on. There's been no evidence presented of those specific issues. All we have within the affidavit is the simple attestation that the hard drive could not be returned on the day of the contempt hearing because it was no longer in my client's possession. And that is the answer to the contempt question. If there's other alternative forms of remedy out there, like altering or amending judgments, that's something different than what we're dealing with. This is solely an issue of contempt, and the only thing the Court of Appeals has before it reflects that my client couldn't have purged his contempt or complied with the order on the day of the contempt hearing.
Thank you, counsel. Case will stand submitted. We'll issue an opinion in due course.